The enemy is here.
He's here. Where is he?
He'll be searching for the other two boxes, hiding until he has all three, until he's ready.
We have to be ready. You, me, the others.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to Miscarriage of Justice. If you are here, it is most likely on purpose, so the blame rests entirely on you. We are joined by Wesley Goatley, coming to us from atop the Old Bailey. Wes is a London-based sound artist and researcher, also a teacher and lecturer specializing in critical design, speculative filmmaking. And if I interpreted his work correctly, he thinks that smart home devices are really tops and beyond reproach. So, in addition to all that, he's a great cook, so I think he knows a little something about taste, and we're going to have a great discussion about Justice League. Wesley, welcome.
A very generous introduction, specifically about the great cook. The doctorate thing I don't care about. The great cook, that's what I want to be known for, you know.
So they're handing out doctorate degrees just willy-nilly these days.
I mean, I got one, you know, that's demonstrable. It's evident.
So does speculative filmmaking, does that cover the work of our pal Zack Snyder?
In a word, no.
He was speculating on something, wasn't he?
What we could speculate as to what he was speculating on. And obviously you two have been speculating for weeks now as to what he's been speculating. Just for everybody, you know, everybody at home, you know, when I was asked to come and do this, I was like, oh, that'd be good. And I thought, should I re-watch the Snyder Cut? And I just thought, no. But the nice upswing of that is that I've now listened to you two talk for longer about the Snyder Cut than the length of the actual Snyder Cut. Because we are now at that point, I think you're at like 5.5 hours maybe or something of this. Easy. I don't know how that makes you feel about what your contribution is. And maybe that just tempers every time you say, well, the sound is so long. It's insanely long, you know. You're also only, what, two-thirds of the way through? Half the way through? Have you reached the halfway point yet in the podcast?
We are through the looking glass. We are at the halfway point. I think we only have the last true part and the epilogue to go.
Yeah, but all those episodes haven't dropped yet. So I think we've aired about two-thirds of it.
Wow. So wait, so can you inform me what the true part is? Is there a bit that I should have been watching all this time that was the capital T, you know?
There are six chapters plus a prologue and then the excruciatingly long epilogue.
Don't remind me of any of this. I mean, I know I'm here to talk about it, but don't... I'm asking for something back here, you know, please don't remind me.
So you did the first question we have of all our guests, you have already answered, which is you have seen, but not rewatched the Snyder Cut. And so love to get kind of two pieces of information. One, what made you watch it in the first place? And if it's some kind of bet or debt that you can't disclose, you know, that's understandable. And then kind of just initial thoughts on it based on that viewing.
So I was somewhat pressured into it by my partner, who was like, let's do like a big chewing gum epic of a Sunday night. You know, and we're still sort of in lockdown over here for good and for bad. So it was like, sure, we've got nothing else to do. Let's do it. And, you know, and I pay a lot of attention to contemporary media. You know, I write a lot about the way that things are interpreted or suggested to be out in the world, particularly in like contemporary media spaces and technology spaces. And I feel like this kind of crosses over a lot because obviously so much of the film's existence is based around a social media campaign that also ended up being a billboard and FA Cup match at some point. Exactly. For those of you who can't see their faces, they're doing this sort of like sideways what the fuck face, which is the correct face to do, but is unfortunately lost in the podcast medium. And so I was like, oh, can I really be bothered to watch like 4 hours of something which I'm pretty sure is going to be shit? But I did, because it was Sunday night and there's nothing else to do on a Sunday night in England in lockdown. You know, there's no pubs open to have a fight in. So it's like, what are we going to do? And that was the context in which I watched it. And I watched it all in one sitting, like Hercules would, because it did feel like, but towards the end, I was really like, all right, are we just going to get to the nightmare bit so I can say I've done all this now and then move on? So yeah, that's the context in which I saw it.
So when you reference the nightmare bit, are you just talking about that, you know, the film itself is a nightmare, or were you already aware that the, what we're referring to as the epilogue,
the right? nightmare.
Yeah.
No, I'm speaking specifically about the slide at the start about it being, you know, just Zack Snyder's wet dream in 4:3 or whatever, however it's phrased. That's the nightmare that I'm referring to.
Okay. Cause we've recently learned that his sequel to this movie was going to be called Zack Snyder's Nightmare, spelled with a K. And the epilogue, so, you know, the sandblasted end sequence is basically the 40-minute teaser of that nightmare.
And now I'm just going to maybe make myself seem very uncool in this instance, that I know a lot about the film and the DCEU and the DC universe, but I very rarely consume any of that media sort of directly. I consume a lot of it through wikis, because I think it's kind of, you know, that's sort of more the structuring of a universe, like a mythical fictional universe over like 70 years is quite interesting to me. But actually taking the time to read all of the inevitable dross of comics, you know, from like the 80s, or, you know, where there's probably just like a ton of like really, really dreadful racial stereotypes being wheeled out or something. I just think I could probably live without doing that. So I'll just precy it all down in the wiki. So all the stuff around the nightmare, et cetera, and also like his whole pitch about that's what he wants to do next and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I'm unfortunately really well versed in all of that.
All right. And so you've talked to that you're familiar with the DC universe, which is kind of the other question that we ask of folks, is that do you have a feeling about kind of comic book movies or and then more specifically the DC, you know, the somewhat fragmented DC universe, you know, in general? Do you have a feeling about those, good or bad?
Yeah, see, so I've totally got a horse in this race, in the sense that, like, pretty much the only things I go and see in the cinema these days is cinema. A really, really weird English way to say that.
What would be? It just sounds like, if an American said it would sound pretentious. But yeah, theater. We just call them theaters.
It does. Right. Would you say it sounds more pretentious because
of the accent? Yeah.
No, this is. I was about to say, I need to tone down that. I mean, already, like, being English on an American podcast, you're already basically people thinking you're either a butler or B, some sort of wizard. I don't know.
Could be both.
It could be both. I'm just gonna try Dutch. Apologies, everybody.
Justice League has taught us anything, it's that you're remotely controlling the EQ of this podcast while sipping a finger of brandy somewhere in a waistcoat. So.
Yeah, I mean, he is the best part of this film, better than J.K. Simmons, I would say. But anyway, so the question was around the kind of filmic comic book universes. So the only times I go to see a movie in person nowadays, as in a cinema with people around me, in the last like 10 years, basically, has always been to see the Marvel films. So the MCU, because I just like that big kind of pomp and ceremony of it. Where I go, I live in South London, and where I go here in South London is like a £5 cinema, which is something like $250. I'm not sure.
that sounds right.
But right. Yeah, it's about that. I'm pretty sure. It's like, you know, it's like 0.2 of a euro. It's super cheap cinema, so like everyone comes basically, and so like everything that happens on screen, people are just like, fucking hell, you know, look at that, it's a shield flying through the air, you know, this is incredible. And I just love that response to things, and it's just so much fun to be in that area, you know. And I otherwise operate in quite like an intellect, you know, hyper intellectualized space where everyone's trying to sort of save face to some degree, and so I just like being in those rooms where everyone's just being like, fuck it, I'm stoked that Thanos just got hit in the face, you know. So I have watched those films a lot, actually, and I just, whenever they're repeated back in the cinema, I just go and see them, because they're, yeah, I like that whole experience they bring along. So I've got a horse in the race of comic book movies, definitely.
Excellent. And where, I mean, does the DC cinematic universe slot in there?
I mean, same as for everybody else, isn't it? I think everybody else is like, oh yeah, because they made some films as well, right?
Right.
They're like, oh yes, and there was a Batman film. Was there a Batman film? You know, was that, what happened? Is Dark Knight? You know, those sorts of things. Because obviously, isn't it weird that the Christopher Nolan films, no one really takes those seriously as part of like the DCEU, which right. feels
they're,
like a
they're their own thing, yeah.
Exactly. And you know, what I think was good about those films is they don't really feel like comic book films at all. And you know, a lot of people said this at the time. But the DC, so I didn't see Man of Steel in the cinema because I was like, I don't give a shit about Superman. You know, I'm just like, and no one else seemingly does either, because obviously the film did pretty badly. I did go and see Batman versus Superman, I think, in the cinema, because I was like, let's see whether or not this DC thing has a hold on everybody else and is going to give me this, you know, this thrill of everyone being stoked. But then I remember going to cinema and no one else was there. So I was like, wait, I'm not here for the film. I'm here for everyone else having a good time, you know. So I saw that, you know, and so I get some of the stuff that's seeded in the Snyder Cut, because obviously it's the Snyderverse thing, and I get some of the stuff that he sort of planted or claims to have planted in the earlier films, where really it's mostly just fans who read much more deeply and more interestingly of the films, and he's gone, oh, actually that's a really good idea, I'll bring that in, you know, which there's a few examples of, I think.
I'm still baffled by the FA Cup billboard thing. Was it like hashtag release the Snyder Cut? What was going on?
Yeah.
That's what it was?
The release the Snyder Cut, like, I don't even want to call them nerds, because I feel like that's giving them like some sort of like cultural cachet that I'm not sure they deserve, you know.
They're fucking psychopaths, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the phrase like toxic fandom is obviously thrown around a lot right now, but that was like pretty brutal, because there was that, wasn't there like an executive for Warner Brothers Films, a woman who had to delete her Twitter account because of the amount of abuse that she got, because she had Warner Brothers somewhere in her like Twitter bio handle. It was pretty grim stuff. But so they raised a bunch of money, I remember. And I think it might have been the time, because they at one point they raised a bunch of money and put half of it into like advertising for release of Snyder Cut. This would have been 2019, I think. And then half of it went to a suicide prevention charity. So like, you know, a much more valuable institution. But then like 6 months later, so I think it was last summer, they paid for like 4 minutes total of digital billboard time during one of the FA Cup games. I think it was on Middlesbrough versus Tottenham maybe. And they just would just occasionally flash up, release the Snyder Cut. And it was just total, I mean, it's quite interesting, because it's a bit of a, you know, it's a grassroots campaign in the space that's normally occupied by people like Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
But in this instance was occupied by a bunch of people who felt, you know, that this thing needed to exist. So that's the FA, the weird FA Cup story. I'm just trying to highlight or justify my relevance of being here as an English. It's like, I'll bring some FA Cup knowledge. I'll pretend like I know much of anything about football. No one will question it, because they just assume that it's a cultural thing, blah, 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 you know.
It's, yeah, I had no, I mean, I kind of missed out on any explicit examples of the release the Snyder Cut thing. I kind of like, for me, I caught all up to it after the fact, like when the movie was released, when I saw it like HBO sent me an email about it. I was like, oh, what's this absolute nonsense? And then kind of watched it and I was like, oh, it, you know, this took me forever. I feel I'm in like a fugue state at some point. Then I read like, oh, this was released and is, I think Ian and I have kind of coined it like not by popular demand, but by particular demand, by like a certain group of people like banging their pots and pans together. And I read all that stuff. And that's what I was like fascinated about. And just like, oh, this is essentially to appease like just a gaggle of like yelling, I don't know, drywall punchers, just like whatever other kind of pop culture pejorative there is. And I'm glad, or not even glad, but fascinated that it made it over the ocean. That like, because I kind of assume this as being a uniquely American thing, an American product, but I guess it's really not, because so many of these movies now just bank on doing well in China anyway, right? That's like a lot of their reason for existence.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's interesting when you talk about like the spread of information between America and the US, is that because so much of this happened on Twitter specifically, you know, and people on Twitter are like, it's the platform of the world. But if you look at actual data on who uses Twitter and where, it's almost entirely, I mean, so much of it's in English for one thing. And the actual geolocative tags of who uses Twitter, it's basically just the US and only certain parts of the US and the UK. And when you look at some more demographic details about who in those countries are using it, it's just people in media. It's people in media being like, this is it. This is the center of the world. Speak to any like normal fucking human. And they're like, what, are you still looking at Twitter? Like, we're on TikTok. Like, what are you doing over there? You know? So that, because I think because it's hashtaggery on Twitter specifically, I think that's why it was such a presence in the UK, because yeah, that social media platform takes up a lot of brain space in the media, but not in normal, reasonable, sane people, you know, are less active. So then it gets reamplified through newspapers, because all the media people think that, you know, they just look at Twitter for their sources, so they don't have to do any work anymore, because they're all like super overworked and underpaid, and they have to deliver on you know, an insane deadlines these days, because it's like a 24/7 news cycle and yada yada. So there is this like weird seep of technology into this space as well, that means that anybody in the UK cared about this whatsoever. But I definitely had it rammed pretty far down my throat for a while, I would say, before it came out.
I what you say about the Twitter thing, I also experience. I always use my mom as the barometer. Like, if I were to call my mom and be like, hey mom, Bean Dad's been canceled, she would just assume that I'm kidnapped, right? And that like, this is my version of like blinking three times in an airport kind of thing. So yeah, it was, and Ian and I talked a little bit about this before, how there's been like a kind of slow, not trend, but like a build of certain things in film in particular being brought about by Twitter demand, right? Like make Samuel L. Jackson say, you know, fucking snakes on the plane, make Sonic the Hedgehog look different. But this was basically like, oh, we're releasing this 4-hour movie because a grip of people. And I think your point too about the people who are looking at Twitter give it an outsized right, they're like, the map is the territory, right? And I'm not even looking at a corner of the map, like this is the whole globe, and it's lighting up in all the places that matter and only those places.
Yeah exactly. And you know, the Sonic the Hedgehog reference is really interesting there, because of course that is possibly the only localized reference we can think of where like a film is clearly, there was a clear shift, you know, like I can't really, maybe either of you two might think of something else, but I can't think of another film in the last few years and therefore probably ever, where there's been that much demand for like a change that's a kind of a conceptual narrative change, some sort of, you know, composerly shift that is being demanded, and then it just happens. Because the Sonic the Hedgehog thing was really interesting, because obviously, A, that first Sonic did look shit. Like,
terrified. It was nightmare food.
It really was, wasn't it? Like, what the fuck were they thinking?
You know? David Cronenberg's Sonic the Hedgehog. Like,
yeah. Which is, I mean, I didn't watch that because I was like, surely this is shit. But, I mean, apparently a bunch of people said it was good, but I don't know. But I mean, I
liked it. Yeah, it was fun.
Is it good?
Yeah.
I mean, they recently recut Citizen Kane so that when he drops the snow globe, he says Bazinga. So that is on the Amazon streaming services now. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to see it.
I mean, I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, but apparently Citizen Kane has been replaced at the top of the Rotten Tomatoes rankings when we're talking more about digital culture with Paddington 2. Paddington 2, which I don't know whether or not it's got a subtitle, but maybe it's like Paddington 2, this time it's on the moon. That would be the only thing that I can imagine that would give it 100%, you know, because I'm like, wow, Paddington on the moon, like, yeah, all right, let's have a look, you know.
Paddington 2, Octopussy. Yeah, it's like, and that, yeah. And that's, I mean, the Paddington 2 thing, I never would have predicted we would have gone here, but you know, this is a jazz podcast, ultimately. We just follow the notes, and that is an interesting thing because I've seen that keep popping up where it's like Citizen Kane lost its perfect rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It has been replaced by Paddington 2. Paddington Takes Manhattan. And that's like even news, right? That like it doesn't change Citizen Kane. I mean, the Bazinga thing is now in there. But like outside of that, it doesn't change Citizen Kane. It's just that people on a website aggregator voted differently, yet that passes for news. And I don't know if I'm kind of conflating that passes for news simply because it's a 24-hour news cycle, or that there is this shift that like, no, people are going to demand, like now what people are voting for and demanding and the little thumb logos, that creeps into the executive boardroom in ways that it never did before.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and the parallel space is, you know, that we see in both the rise to the top of Paddington 2, the new batch, as well as say, you know, the whole Stonks fiasco, GameStop stuff, you know, of there being there's a strange power that are coming from those spaces, but they all seem to be coming from the weirdest spaces of the internet. I haven't looked into the Paddington 2 thing, but I can only imagine it's just a bunch of nerds on Reddit who think it's funny to do that, because I'm sure it's not actually a genius film. But, you know, there were a number of examples recently where that kind of critical mass of hucksterism, perhaps, you know, on Reddit comes through. And, you know, let's just kind of go straight into where we're going, obviously, with the topic of this podcast. But this leads pretty directly to QAnon, I would say. You know, that there's, I like that. That's the look of like, are we really going there?
You're right. Let's go.
But, you know, the sense of there being this kind of critical mass of a slightly pranksterish air that then takes on a strange seriousness and has a real effect on the world, you know, that QAnon feels like it's probably exactly that. You know, if anybody spent any time on 4chan, there's loads of that nonsense on there for years, and it just kind of like has sort of snowballed. And it feels like the Snyder Cut feels a bit like that for me, perhaps, that there is this notion that that this is maybe something that kind of ran out of control, or something that then just became bigger than it ever should have been because of some outsider, you know, kind of pressures or situations, possibly something. I mean, I kind of feel like it might be coronavirus related personally, but I mean, that's just looking at the timeline, really.
Definitely a factor. But I mean, it has me wondering if democracy was actually a really bad idea. I mean, you look at IMDb and you look at their top rated films, and it's always just going to be the most anodyne, banal shit at the top. Like, it's always good, you know. It's not going to be Citizen Kane. Like, Rotten Tomatoes is another thing, but it's always going to be shit like Star Wars, A New Hope, which of course I loved when I was a kid. Or like, I think the number one rated movie on there is going to be Shawshank Redemption forever. And it's going to be, you know, my favorite movie of all time is not going to be even on there, but the first one that of my...
Wait, Ian, what's your favorite film of all time?
It goes back and forth. It's probably Stalker.
Oh, yeah.
Good. Yeah. Not going to be in the top 1,000 most likely because most people haven't seen it. But like, yeah, is democracy a good idea when it leads to things like Paddington 2 being voted the best movie of all time and QAnon?
So I just realized that with the, another option for the Paddington 2 gag could be Paddington 2, The Last Jedi. That also tracks. So thanks for reminding me that there's a whole Star Wars subtitle thing coming along.
But Paddington 3, he's played by a female bear and people lose their fucking minds. People, the streets run run brown with torn up fur. It is. Well, what I think is interesting about this too, and kind of into your comment about, you know, is democracy a good idea in this or any form, you know, to which I would resoundingly say no.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. Democracy simply doesn't work.
There has been this shift of like, right, executives in any capacity, right? Whether they're trying to sell you a film, they're trying to sell you a toothpaste. Although I don't think that we've gotten to the point of like Twitter sourcing toothpaste flavors yet, but maybe we have, right? There'll be a nuts and gum teeth darkening toothpaste soon enough. But it's gone from like trying, you know, and having all these mechanisms of polling people in focus groups and putting a box inside every whatever it was 20th American household to measure what television shows people were watching, trying to like do all that stuff. And now you just have this floodgate for anyone that wants to tell you can just bark exactly what they want at you. And I think what's kind of turned is that it's gone from like, oh, we're trying to do analytics, right? We're trying to like Nate Silver this and like really make sure we have the right representative samples and blah, blah, blah. And it's just some folks stuck at home because there's a pandemic can crank up one hashtag over the other. And people that barely know how hashtag works are just like, all right, but put the money behind that. Put the money behind the 4-hour sad movie where Superman is asleep for 95% of it.
I mean, there is something there about that word demand that keeps coming in when people say they demanded the Snyder Cut. You know, when if you look at the way that Warner Brothers talked about this, they were saying that, you know, we respond to audience demand, of course, you know, as a responsive media, you know, like agency or whatever. But then that word demand did seem to come track through in all of the really like sort of grim, violent parts of how this film got made as well, in terms of like the threats, the weird abuse on, you know, so that there's a power there that's very tainted, but was actioned, you know. And I wonder what that means in terms of if a quote unquote fandom can be quote unquote toxic as this, you know, as like leveraging all sorts of weird forms of abuse and then get what they want. That's a worrying precedent for me.
It makes me the whole Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb wisdom, and I'm using the most extreme version of scare quotes here, wisdom of the crowd, always makes me think about Yelp. Wes, do you guys even have a Yelp over there?
What's that?
Yelp.com is like you rate local businesses.
Sorry, Ian, I'm totally joking.
Son of a bitch. I didn't know if it was a thing. Like, we don't have Deliveroo over here. So if you said that to Nat, he might not know what you're talking about.
Just as a context for you, Ian, when I used to spend a lot of time in the US now and again on tour and whatever, I would always pronounce the name of the fruit avocado. And convince all Americans around me that's how everyone in England said it. And it would be like, oh, really? That's interesting. And I'd just start again. This is great.
Say oregano, though, so it's totally plausible.
It's true. And we also, I mean, as Eddie Izzard makes clear, we also say herb instead of herb because it's
a H.
Well, okay, you have an extra E at the end of Yelp out there, don't you? Isn't it Y-E-L-P-E?
Yeah. And we call it Ye Olde Yelp.
Ye Olde Yelp.
All websites are prefaced with Ye Olde. So,
but my point about Yelp, which apparently you guys do have in the UK, is that only absolute psychopaths are driven to review anything. So it's like the horrible Karens who you know, feel that they were, you know, slightly slighted by somebody at the business, or like if you're a friend of the restaurateur and you are compelled, you know, they ask you directly to review their thing. Like none of the middle ground of folks who got decent service ever leave a review. It's only the people who have an axe to grind, or the people who got like really remarkable service. So it's really the spectrum is completely skewed from the start. And I feel like that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with extreme ends of the spectrum in situations like the hashtag release the Snyder Cut.
Yeah, totally. And also there's a third group there of like botnets, right? People who just pay for a ton of bots. Yep. To go great service, quality product, A plus, you know, a billion times. And, you know, who knows, like, how much of the release of Snyder Cut retweets were botnets, you know. Probably, I doubt organized by, like, the grand mastermind, Zack Snyder, because that gives him a lot more, you know, kudos than I think that he probably is deserving in that space. Or even Warner Brothers, who seem mostly clueless. But, I mean, there will be a lot, you know, this was a very Reddit-centric and Twitter-centric hashtag push. And those are people who do deploy those sorts of things. So yeah, it's interesting to wonder how few people actually really wanted this and how few people potentially made it happen.
I think you've touched on, I think, the crux of the entire thing right there. Ultimately, it was Warner Brothers' decision to move ahead with this. And they're like, I don't know, we're into this thing for $650 million and we haven't recouped. If we throw another $100-150 million at it, is it possible that we could actually like get back in the black with this? Like, let's roll with this. So I could definitely, you know, I'm not saying that they were behind the initial push, but ultimately the decision was the bean counters at Warner Brothers. And at some point, you know, in their financial modeling, like it clicked to where, you know, this is going to make financial sense for us. We're going to move ahead with it. That had to have been how it went down.
And I think the launch of HBO Max, you know, had to be a factor in that, right? Because the only bit of refreshing I did before this is I was like, let me just check the timeline so I remember like what happened, because end of 2019, start of 2020 is very fucking hazy for me, as it is for most people. So I was like, wait, like, when did that happen? But so end of 2019, they declared it's not happening. Fuck you, it's not happening. You know, and a bunch of people were just like, oh, it should happen. Does it even exist? Is there even such a thing? Yada, yada, yada. And then end of 2019, they say they started having conversations. And it wasn't until like end of February 2020, which is when we knew that the things were hitting the fan in a serious way by that point, generally. That's when it started to get greenlit. And I think that the cast members weren't even told till May, I think, is what I read. So the people who were going to be involved in reshoots, you know. So it does seem like there is like a tactical thing where they're like, right, like this is going to last for X amount of time. This will last for 3 weeks, you know. We'll all be inside for 3 weeks.
I remember that, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I think May or some point in May is when HBO Max was launched. And I think there was probably like quite a tactical thing of like, well, let's try and get this done while that happens. And then, you know, if we're still inside at this point, then at least it can be the thing that launches on the platform, perhaps, you know. And then obviously it was rolling on, and then he was asking for reshoots and they didn't want to spend money, but then they wanted like an extra 70 million or something, which is not much to generate what they got out of it. 70 million is, you know, fuck all realistically, you know, to get what they got out of it. So yeah, it's weird to see how that worked out for them, but it does seem like it's a very kind of pandemic, possibly like, you know, pandemic enabled process, because otherwise they wouldn't have probably wanted to risk putting out in the cinemas, you know, but knowing it's going to be online is always seen as somewhat of a safer space where you can test stuff out. Or maybe, you know, the history of like direct to video is just kind of like keep it out of the cinemas. If it's not that good, just push it straight to TV, you know? So I wonder if there was all those narratives that were in play as well, when they really thought, actually, this is probably going to be shit, but somebody will watch it, you know?
It's something we talked about earlier. I think a lot of this is contingent on people being stuck at home.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and I've talked about how I would imagine people are trying to recreate this phenomenon about it, right? Because as you were talking about, they're like, it doesn't even exist. And they gave it kind of this like mythical state, right? I mean, whether it was actually accepted by people or not, but it's like, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's like, does it even exist? Oh, he says it does. And our guest Eileen talked about how, you know, he references like, you know, I've got a cut on my laptop that I'll strap guests down, you know, my delivery driver, I'll drag them in the house, you know, and force them to watch it. And that all paid off, right? At this point, it all kind of paid off. And if there's one thing that kind of Hollywood or the entertainment industry has shown us, it's that once there's an idea that lands, they will do it to death. And so I can't imagine that they won't try to do this again, but I do think they know that like, you can't just 2 months from now be like, guess what? There's a Paddington 2 cut that, what's his fate? The Paddington 2 cut that's Dog Me 95, and we will release it if right there's
the Lars von Trier,
there's a Von Trier, Paddington and Charlotte Gainsborough go away for the weekend with disastrous results. I derailed myself with my own reference there.
I did not expect her to cut Paddington's dick off, but here we are.
I'm going to tell a real quick Lars von Trier relevant story. So a friend, somebody I know is a very famous sound recordist, works on loads of great stuff. He's brilliant. I'm not going to give his name just in case it exposes him somewhat to this, but he was working on Black Swan, which is von Trier, right? Am I remembering
this right? That's Fincher, isn't it?
I thought that was Aronofsky.
Oh, it was Aronofsky. You're right.
Wait,
it
might not have been Black Swan in that instance. No, wait, no, it's Dancer in the Dark. Dancer in the Dark, which is Lars
Bjork. Yeah.
Yes, Bjork.
Both treat their female protagonists with the utmost disdain. So,
Exactly why I mistook them, because I was like, yeah, these are both horrible, yeah. So he said that apparently von Trier would, he had a bunch of esoteric, shall we say, activities, i.e. he was a fucking dick. So he would just ask hyper-personal questions of like new people on set and stuff like this, like really absurd. Not stuff that like pushed it the boundary into abuse per se, but stuff that was just like pretty, you know, beyond the pale, as we might say, you know, for this sort of discussion. But someone said, he said after he got onto the set, someone leaned into him and said, have you seen Lars's piss gnome? And he's like, what? I said, have you seen Lars's piss gnome?
Piss gnome.
Piss gnome. He says, no. He's got like a little bear, like a little model bear. Which is why this is my tenuous connection to the Lars von Trier and Paddington. That he put out the back of the soundstage in a field, and that is the only place he would piss would be on the little bear, and everyone referred to it as his piss gnome.
What the fuck?
And that's my whenever I watch or think or hear anything about Lars von Trier, I just think he's got a piss gnome. That's a guy with perhaps many piss gnomes. I don't know what the collective noun for piss gnomes are. You know, a murder of piss gnomes, perhaps. I don't know. But there's
a pride of piss gnomes.
No, it's not a pride. It's definitely not a pride of piss gnomes. But can I ask you both a question related, if I backtrack my own piss gnome story?
We're gonna start the episode there, as a note, right? Let's clap in just
a fade in of me saying piss gnome.
Three, two, one.
So when we're talking about, you know, the things that this may have really occurred in, mostly because of a lockdown thing and everyone kind of being stuck inside and this being a somewhat perhaps like exasperated, you know, outpouring of demand that produced this, and also Warner Brothers seeing this kind of like, you know, a trapped audience, which everyone loves. Can I ask you both, do you think you would be doing this podcast about this film if it wasn't for the fact that you probably didn't have that much else to do that you either normally would do? Like, would you have done this podcast in like March 2019?
100% no.
Yeah. I probably never would have even seen the movie. I mean that like I somewhat famously only watch Law and Order on cable television, right? I need the most like safety blanket media, world collapse, right? Even like 5 years ago, that was just like my preferred, you know, kind of thing. So yeah, I think that for me, the pandemic absolutely was the reason I saw the thing in the first place, as I imagine it was for a lot of other people. And I need something to do all the time. And that has been severely limited. And this is something you can do from your bedroom.
I probably would have seen the film because I am just a voracious consumer of filmed entertainment, but I certainly wouldn't, there would be no podcast about it. I mean, I remember Nat and I exchanging text messages about it. I was like, can you believe, like, did you see this thing? Can you believe it? It exists. Is it real? Like, and then we started, you know, exchanging hot takes. And then it became clear that we needed to dissect this. We needed a space in which to process our feelings about this. And that, you know, a podcast sort of lent itself to that. And here we are, you know, several weeks, many, many weeks later.
So like, let's connect this to the overall like thrust of like how this thing got together and the satisfaction probably from the point of view of the Snyder Cut weirdos, you know, who've seen this now born to fruit. Do you feel that you've got a satisfaction at expressing yourselves in the new context, you know, in a pandemic? Is there something about the pandemic that's made you feel particularly satisfied about being able to do this podcast, for example? Is it that you felt perhaps, and I might be projecting a bit here because this is how I felt, that like being locked in and being denied some of the expressions you normally, outward expressions, as you know, we're all in like arts and performance and stuff. You know, like I had a bunch of exhibitions that were canceled at the end of March, start of April. And then I had like two in the last 12 months and that's been it. You know, they've all been in countries where they handled the coronavirus way better than the West. So like, I think there has been like this kind of repression somewhat of creative energy that's been produced here. And I feel like perhaps that's somewhat part of the feeling, the satisfaction that people are getting from seeing this thing, the Snyder Cut out on screen. But are you feeling that sense of satisfaction yourself in doing this podcast? Just, the silence is wonderful.
I mean, I need people to listen to me constantly, right? And so that's it's just not the same, you know, if I'm wearing a mask and I'm 6 feet away from them and I'm just like, can you see the Snyder Cut? Can you, this is the fucking bullshit. I either go to one of two directions. If you know, people who have listened to this and you guys both know me, I either go like hyper serious or I'm like, remember when Hans Molman got hit with a football in the groin? And I'm actually going to use this to kind of go the super serious route, because I was thinking before about what we were talking about, like, you know, this was willed into existence by basically, we can call it like political action, essentially. And one of the things that's come to my mind, and this is definitely making a mother box out of a molehill, is like, we can demand, and by we, I mean the collective we, the royal we can demand things like the Snyder Cut, but at least in this country, and you guys seem to soon be joining us, can't get things like healthcare or right or taxation that makes sense for the vast majority of people. And I think that as we enter into this, or we've already entered into it, but as we continue to kind of wade through this environment in which we're hyper-connected, in which our voices are able to be heard, we are in this place where it's like, I know at least for me, it feels like you have minimal impact on the stuff that really like materially affects you, right? Because if I can get my favorite movie released, if I can get, you know, the Matthew Barney cut of Paddington 2 released, I still can't get, right? Like I said, I can't turn the tide on environmental collapse, which is you know, a close second to me to the Matthew Barney cut of Paddington 2. And so I think that, yeah, for me, like, this is kind of, and especially as you mentioned in this time where, like, you are definitely like under heel in a lot of ways. Yeah. Just being able to be like, ah, here's what I think about this thing. Listen to me is kind of the reaction. Right. And as I said, for me, that's tied back into that environment and be like, yeah, you can get people to come together and have a film released and we can't pick from the long list, pick from the long laundry list of things that would improve people's collective livelihoods. And those are all, for whatever reason, just complete fucking non-starters. So yeah, I mean, in essence, yes.
Mass politics is well and truly dead in the West. I mean, I'm sort of making a statement and a question. Certainly in the US, like, mass politics is dead. We can't move anybody on any political issue to improve the material conditions of most people's lives. But yeah, I think I'm agreeing with Nat 100% that we can agitate for a thing that ultimately doesn't matter. And Wes, I think to your point, I don't even think the people who asked for this are satisfied. There is no way that they might have enjoyed it, but the hole that they were looking to fill is far too large for something like the Snyder Cut. Even if they got everything that they wanted, they were never going to be satisfied because the Snyder Cut is no substitution, no replacement for a material improvement to our lives, which is, I think, what we probably, even if we are not prepared to admit it, what we all want and need.
Yeah, and I think you're totally right, Ian, in that, like, if you see immediately the hashtag release the Snyderverse was that night, the night that it was that the film was showing, that rocketed straight up. And now there's like release the, is it Ayer, David Ayer, the guy,
the Ayer cut of Suicide Squad, yes.
Yeah, just being like, oh my, yep, just release all the cuts. Maybe one of them will bring us joy. <You know.
laughs> Spoiler, it will not. It won't.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I think, yeah, you had talked about, I mean, and granted, this is like a fun and enjoyable movie, which, you know, two things that the Snyder Cut isn't, but someone had basically said, like, yeah, there's like an 8-hour cut of Godzilla versus King Kong. And you're like, no, that's just the raw footage. Like, right, we're at this point, we're talking about, yeah, and I think it's a little highfalutin, but I also think it is accurate that, yeah, this is kind of like striving for, you know, for meaning in an environment in which, you know, the actual, like, getting meaning from, you're like, oh, I'm secure in my person, right? Like, it's, yeah, I think as we slouch into like a Hobbesian state of war, right? A Hobbesian state of nature, instead of being like, well, we should probably try to have some type of like social contract, we're like, yeah, life's still like going to be poor, solitary, nasty, brutish, and short, but I want my pictures. I want my shows, right? Like, that's like what we're going for. We're like,
I need my stories.
Yeah.
Mama needs her stories.
You kids knock it off. Mama's watching her stories.
I don't know if we need to jump into this now, if you have any other kind of, well, actually, well, one thing you had mentioned is, and I think you said this in the voicemail you left, so I was introducing something that I'm very eager to get to, but we'll pause on it for a second. Yeah. About whether or not anyone enjoyed this, and without like kind of diving into solipsism, so we'll kind of like write like never really know, but I think that you have to convince yourself you do, because you got the thing you wanted. Right. And I think 100%. That's why you're seeing like some of these fawning reviews. I probably spent like a solid week looking exclusively at like YouTube clips, which, who knows, I'm sure a lot of those responses are bots and other stuff. And it was just like individuals being like, finally, I can, you know, my dad passed away, you know, last week from COVID, but this makes it all worth it because I was able to see two CGI blobs fight on the Windows 95 screen. And I think that is
someone said that. You know, someone said that somewhere.
Oh, like, well, also,
you know that someone's lived experience is that.
Well, and this is another, this is a total, not a total aside, but from spending a lot of time perusing YouTube comments, I was in the stacks of the YouTube comments, right? I'm in the like basement section of the library from Ghostbusters, right? I'm in the New York library, just like in the YouTube comment section, microfiche of YouTube comments. We're gonna have to edit out all my library references. but people on YouTube love saying, I'm watching this and I just suffered this incredibly personal tragedy. Like that is the form that YouTube comments take. And sometimes I'm like, this can't possibly be true. And so I was like, my dog died in a fight with my dad, who also, you know, succumbed to his industries. But the only thing that brings me joy is listening to Limp Bizkit's Starfish and the Chocolate Flavored Water. Like that's
same.
Yeah. but so the thing I was going to ask you is you came in here with a blazing hot take, and you just dropped it. You dropped it like it was a bowler cap that, you know, that the maid was going to pick up. Jeremy Irons' Alfred is the best part of this film.
I've got a feeling, because we haven't mentioned the fact that I was the person who left that voicemail.
We have not.
You slightly alluded to it at the start, right? But I don't think we've actually said, this is that guy who left that. It's the English guy who left the voicemail in like episode 3 or something.
I mean, I assumed that people would realize that the one English person who left the voicemail and the English voice on the podcast would, although in true Zack Snyder fashion, we should have just given complete exposition about it, right?
You should have played Englishman in New York. You should have played Englishman in New York. If only you were both on the East Coast. I don't believe there's an Englishman in like California. But
I'm sure that's what Sting does when he plays like San Francisco, right? He like changes up the name of wherever he is. Is that am I even thinking of the right song? Is that a Sting song?
I don't know. I always think of the Alan Partridge joke. That was Roxanne by the Police, or as they're now known, Sting. And so all of Police and Sting's songs just blur into one. I can no longer extract one from the
Incredible.
Other.
Incredible.
Yeah. Towards your question, Nat, about Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons is awesome. Jeremy, if anybody thinks there's a better actor in this film than Jeremy Irons, I know you're going to fight me on this one, Nat, I'm pretty sure. But Jeremy Irons is amazing. Like, how do they get Jeremy Irons in here? He does, as you've said about everybody, J.K. Simmons specifically, who handles the turd dialogue that they're given, he does a good job of, and I think maybe Jeremy Irons' problem is he has too many scenes because there's too many opportunities for, like, the bad dialogue to come through. Mm-hmm. But still, I just like Jeremy Irons' vibe that, you know, that Jeremy Irons is in this. And also, he's, like, probably 6 months older than Ben Affleck or something like that. But, you know, he's, like, framed as being his butler. But I think Jeremy Irons is awesome.
He is doing yeoman's work. Like he is doing his best to make that shit dialogue sing, and he can't do it. But that's through no shortcomings of his. He is working his ass off. You can see the pain in his eyes as he's delivering this dog shit dialogue, and just yeah, even he can't save it. That's how bad it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to fight you because I'm from Boston and you were trying to impose taxes on me, for which I disagree.
I'm not even Irish, so there's not even that kinship that we have.
Yeah. You're trying to, you and the King of England are just trying to come into my Quonset hut.
Harry, you mean, right? Yeah.
okay, so that's a less. I gave you a harsh interpretation because of your accent. No, I agree that with Ben Affleck as a close second, and again, that's a lot of just, I think, homeboy favoritism. Yes. Jeremy Irons is, yeah, realistically the best actor in this, but yeah, the way Alfred is positioned and just the dialogue he's given to me is so bizarre because he's this weird devil's advocate that there's no need for a devil's advocate in this movie because the plot is just a runaway train, right? There's like nothing. And you, the audience, like you don't even need or appreciate someone being like, have we considered the alternative? Because the answer is always no. It's like, of course not. This is just going to full steam ahead, no matter what. But yeah, I mean, he's doing, he probably needs like pelvic mesh after this from all the hernias he got lifting up this absolute dog shit of a script.
I think Wes's point is absolutely right, is that he is too exposed for having too many lines, for having Batman and Alfred's dynamic be so unattractive. And so it's hard to be empathetic to them because they're just like, I've described them as the Bickersons. It's that couple that, you know, should have been divorced a long time ago, and you invite them over for dinner. You're like, oh fuck, I forgot this part where they're just going to, you know, they're just going to snipe at each other all night. And nobody wants to watch that. And why Terrio and Snyder decided to put it in the script, to Nat's point, it's beyond me. It doesn't need to be there. It doesn't serve any purpose except to make the movie longer.
Yeah. Which is, that's the whole thing, right? Is that like, there's so much that's been said about this film that is like, it's great because you get, and this has been a lot of the reviews are like, great, loads more depth for the characters. What you mean is there was a lot more time on screen for the characters. That's different. There's depth and then there's time. You know, these are two different spatio-temporal, like, you know, metrics that we're dealing with here. And because I don't think that, I mean, watching the two, because I did watch the Whedon one as well, because again, I'm interested in these things as kind of like epics to some degree, but obviously it was very disappointing. But I did notice how much extra time that was given to backstory for some characters, specifically Cyborg mostly. But it was really just about time. They weren't doing a better job. They didn't make anybody care anymore, I think. They just went, here's just some more biography. It's just a slightly longer Wikipedia entry. You still don't have a meaningful interaction with this person.
To that point, Nat and I discussed this on the last episode, the last recap episode, is that we find that he and I are constantly misattributing lines to different characters. Like, who said that? I can't remember. It's because they're all interchangeable. It really doesn't matter. You have the Flash being the sole outlier because he's the comic relief, and then Superman because he doesn't have any lines practically. But the other four people, any one of them could say anything at any time, and it would really not change anything about the film.
And here's, I mean, this is a segue into an interesting point around the Martian Manhunter character, you know, who is literally like playing more, you know, he is playing the role of various things. You do believe that when he comes as Martin or Martha,
that what'd you say?
Why did you say that name?
Why did you say that name?
There's nothing about it that you're like, wait a minute, something going on here. This doesn't sound like the Martha we know. You know, of course you're not doing that at all. You know, so in a weird way, it makes total sense that the Martian Manhunter would be the body they put in there, because that feels very Snyderish in the sense of like, oh yeah, he can just say whatever he wants and be every character and say everything. No one needs any identity. And that's why we're going to have Martian Manhunter in here. Which also, and every time I've heard you both talk about this, in every episode, I keep thinking, is this the episode where they find out? Is this the episode where they find out the Martian Manhunter's name in the comics is John Johns, spelled with two Zs? John Johns is his name. So in terms of like all the absurd names of the Mother Box and of Steppenwolf and everything else, the winner of the absurd name, dickhead name lottery is that they named it John Johns as the alien's name from Mars. He's just two Johns with a double Z at the end.
That is the Joey Jojo Shabadoo Jr. of the DC universe. I did not know. I mean, Ian, have you been withholding John Johns on me? I mean,
no, I literally until about 45 seconds ago, I had no idea that was his name. And it's even better than Wes described it. J'ONNZZ.
So not like, one, but two apostrophes.
Yes.
So like John.
It's like, John. It's Tony. It's, You know, he's a rhythm. He's like a New Jack Swing band from the early 90s.
I wish.
But you know that, like, the like army general guy who you know, he, like, you weirdly see him in the Snyder film again. It's assumed you've seen all the other and you've seen everything else. As I said in the thing that I left, the voicemail that I left, that army general guy. So apparently that was a fan theory, because he's just like a random army general in a room full of army generals in Man of Steel, because he's in the scene where, like, they capture Superman, quote unquote capture him, because Superman's just being there, because he's like, oh, whatever, I'll just come and hang out with these dudes for a while. But there's an army general in there, and there was a fan theory that that was Martian Manhunter, and apparently that's the reason why he became Martian Manhunter, because Zack Snyder liked the fan theory and therefore made that actor the character who then becomes Martian Manhunter.
Absolutely, and that's incredible.
Insane to me. Yeah, I read this today and I was like, wow, that's really, that he's not even on top of his own universe, that he's literally listening to fan input for, like, for better ideas, for better conspiracies than he can hatch to generate this stuff. I mean, when we're talking about the kind of the internet creation myth of this particular film, goes much more than just, like, whether or not we saw the cut that existed. It's like, no, there was, like, fully structural decisions about characters and their arcs and what they're doing that have been influenced by hashtags.
Madness. Absolute madness.
And one of the best parts is that, like, it doesn't matter, right? Like, that's at the end of the day, it's not like that guy is somewhere, right? And that and he needs to do his Martian Manhunter things and it saves the day. Like, as we talk about in one of the episodes, and one of our guests, like, actually explains even better, in the Whedon cut, they have Batman's like, someone go, you know, get Lois Lane. Cause when we bring Superman back and he's all cranky, we need to put his girlfriend in front of him and he'll go okay. And this one is, we, like, kind of fell backwards into, it's like, maybe Martian Manhunter knows they're going to resurrect Superman and he knows that Lois Lane is the only thing that can save him. So he pretends to be Martha Kent. It tells her to, right. And it's just like total, like, Rube Goldberg machine of a plot, which is, again, the only time that the movie ever does that, which is also really interesting. Cause everything else is just like, you strike the match, the flame is lit, the end. There's no other steps in the process. But okay, he didn't have to be Martian. Like, Martha Kent just could have done that. It could have been accidental, right? Because that it is this elaborate thing that works out, and that, like, Martian Manhunter is, you know, the man behind the scenes. He's like, Cyrano de Bergerac-ing this whole thing. That never adds up. Like, that never adds up. And then at the end, when he visits Batman, he's just like, oh, like what you've done with the place. All right, I'll be all right. Like, I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, I needed one shot of Martian Manhunter in the background of the Superman confrontation, tenting his fingers and saying, excellent. Right. It's all going to plan. We never got that.
No, you don't see him again until the very end of the epilogue, right?
Absolutely. Which moronic.
Is also this, it's not even like a gut punch. It's more, you're kind of like, did a bird just shit on me? Right. You're like, I don't. Cause you just watched this 35 minute dream where you're like, oh, people are dead. Superman's bad. Jared Leto is here. Because of reasons. He wakes up, you realize that's not true. And then Batman's visited by Martian Manhunter. And I, again, much like every other line, I forget what he even says to him. Like, he just could be like, hey, I heard that your car warranty is expiring. Like, he just shows up with, Martian Manhunter shows up. He's like, have you heard the good word of Ja'on Ja'ons? Like, here's a pamphlet. Please let me into your house. Yeah.
I'd like to add you to my network on LinkedIn. And also the fact that, and you brought it to someone in the previous episodes, that, like, Ben Affleck just gets out and he's wearing just like PJs. And he's just like, oh, all right. Oh, there's a Martian. How you doing? Oh, okay. All right. See you later. You know, it's like, she's going to get a couple of hours more sleep, actually, because it's quite early Martian person who's literally floating in the air. He acts like he just doesn't give a fuck about it whatsoever. He's just sat there going, all right, flying Martian, what's next?
You know? He's a stand-in there for the audience, because we too do not give a fuck and could not care less about what's happening.
And want to go back to bed.
We just want it to be over, please.
We just need a couple more hours sleep and then this will all make sense.
Yeah.
If only that were true.
Oh, dear.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I amazingly, even though, as I said, we've now talked about this longer than the film itself,
we may have thought about it more than Zack Snyder did, the man who actually made the film.
Oh, yeah.
You probably like referred less to hashtags for content for this than perhaps he did, you know.
Seemingly. Almost certainly.
But I mean, I'm pleased to have like come on today and like turned the lens a little bit towards you in this, because I think it is really interesting that, like, you know, you've neither of you two are necessarily like people who just do a series of movie podcasts, but this movie particularly grabbed you enough at this moment in time. I think it's amazing and sort of like quite wonderful that instead of just being at home fuming about lack of things to do, you're like, fuck it, let's direct some of this energy and some of this ire some way, you know, somewhere in kind of like an entertaining and amusing fashion. But also that you've touched on so many nice, you know, death of American Empire, and objectivism obviously keeps coming back again. You know, it's a really nice way to be running this. So I'm just like glad at this halfway point to be able to just say, can we acknowledge the fact that this is sort of, you know, as much as the Snyderverse is a weird thing to have come through the moment that it has and the way that it has, this, the podcast itself is a strange and interesting thing to have come through in the moment that it has. You know, so congratulations for doing something with your ire and fury that at least had a lot of Simpsons references in it. Because yeah, a lot of people's iron and fury is just like smashing stuff up and being abusive online. But you had some really good deep cut Simpsons references. You've had Extreme's been on here. You know, there was a whole Pixies thing you did. You know, that's productive shit, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully, you know, a few people pick up, you know, read a couple essays, you know, dig into classic Simpsons. As we say, do not watch this movie under any circumstance.
It's radioactive, man, jerk. Just watch the Simpsons instead.
And so as we kind of wrap, any final thoughts on the film, what it represents, what it means, if anything, for, you know, the future of these kind of entertainment products and their not even like serialization, but just their kind of brand status, like moving away from, all right, this is released and it's a standalone piece of art, to be generous, entertainment, and it's like, no, this has to be its own kind of product line. And I don't mean like in the action figure sense, like this just has to kind of keep being reiterated.
There's something satisfying, right? I mean, a lot of people have written about this in the last like 100, more than that. There's been a lot of writing about it in the last 100 years, at least, about like the satisfaction of something that's old returning to you. You know, I mean, a lot of existentialism like kind of grappled with this or was dipping into it. The knowability of something in the past coming to you again, particularly at a time when things, I mean, because the present always feels uncertain, right? 2020 was no more of an uncertain year than 2019 was when we were living it. You know, the notion of a variability of uncertainty is a fallacy. There's no gradient of uncertainty. There's certainty and uncertainty, and that's it. You know, but the fact that there is a certainty in something coming from the past, it's not going to like challenge you that much. I think is very satisfying and calming for a lot of people. I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I mean, and I think there can be some interesting elements that come from that. But I mean, you know, in the last 15 or 20 years, we've seen a lot of it, right? This is not even really a new thing, in spite of the fact that there's a lot of contemporary elements about it, about the pandemic and about Twitter, etc. But I mean, you know, why the fuck have we had so many Transformers films right at the point where people who watched Transformers as a cartoon as kids had disposable income, you know, for the first time, probably because their kids reached about 12 to 15, start hating and ignoring them. They've got more time. They start spending that money because they've you know, they bought a house at a decent time and have got pretty low mortgage. You know, so much of that media was, you know, has been made to be consumed not by children at all, but by adults who are looking back at it. You know, that feels to me, the scale of that media presence feels new. There's always been, you know, the nostalgia has always been an attractive element, but for all these reasons, because the notion of the chaos of the present, the safety of the past, the terror of the future, because there's only one thing in the future that we humans know is coming. There's one thing and one thing only. And so there's all that. Those are like big human things that play themselves through media a lot. This is why I think media is interesting, and I look at it a lot. But I think that in this particular moment, like, we can look at a lot of parts of like the kind of Snyderverse-y things as being a sort of slightly empty part of that. But I mean, you know, not to sort of like jump the rails slightly, but did either of you watch Falcon and the Winter Soldier?
No, I have not.
No.
There's some really interesting handling of race specifically in it, you know, in an American context for when it came out. You sort of look maybe 3 years before, I doubt something like that would have been grappled. There's full grappling with the fact that like the central character is a black man, an African-American man in the US who's claiming the mantle of Captain America. And it's not, you know, it's not like the most erudite or sophisticated view of it, but like, fuck me, it could have been so much worse. And it's really interesting to look at that as being like, that's a sort of a looking backness, because a lot of what they talked about was really rewarding. A lot of the kind of Easter eggs in that show, and so much of the comic book films and the comic book new media are all about Easter eggs. It's all about rewarding you for knowing extra stuff. That a lot of the Easter eggs are really buried in like the 60s and 70s. And the explicit stories happening in that they were pointing back to was stuff that was happening during the times of civil rights movements and things like that. So there's a really interesting tension there about why looking back can sometimes be really valuable at a time like this, you know, that we're living through now. So I think that there is, you know, it's not all just like, oh, everything's, you know, people are just hiding away from the future. They're actually looking back in some way can be really useful and valuable. But like the Snyderverse thing does the kind of empty version of that, I would say.
It does the empty version of that. And it does itself a disservice oftentimes when it does, because so much of the, at least for the Justice League stuff, is based on those Jack Kirby books, which came out in 70, late 60s up through 70, 71 or something like that. And he was doing shit like calling things Apocalypse, L-I-P-S, and inventing mother boxes and shit like that. And like 50 years on, that shit is just wild corny. And, you know, those are the kinds of cultural references that I think Snyder would have been much better served to have left out or renamed or to have rebranded somehow.
I sort of feel like anybody handling who's trying to handle the wider DC universe is always going to be hampered by that, because all the villains are called like Mr. Freeze, like Dr. Freeze, like, you know, Agent Fire, Poison Ivy. You know, they're all like these really shitty names. They're so camp all the way through. And it's been so funny to watch the history of like people, you know, I'm just now thinking of Arnold Schwarzenegger saying, there's a freeze coming, you know, and like, oh, it's so crap.
Can we get that Arnold again? Can we get...
there's a freeze coming. That's as good
as you
think
that Arnold Schwarzenegger is Werner Herzog.
All that Arnold Schwarzenegger knows is that the human nature is merely a line between murder and chaos. if only Arnold Schwarzenegger was patently aware of the fine line between murder and chaos, perhaps California would be in a better state than it is today.
Woof.
Or maybe it'd be in exactly the same state. Who knows?
We can only wait for Caitlyn Jenner to rescue us. No, you're right about, and Ian, you brought this up before. Yeah, the DC names especially, like Joe Chill, the guy that in certain versions murders Batman's parents, was given that name because like Chill is, he's supposed to be like Joe Chill, like the Iceman, right? It's like, and they just keep hanging on to that stuff. And I'm not sure anyone like really cares that much one way or the other, right? Like that they're in Apocalypse with, you know, Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley's behind them, just like, people!
Damn it, it just gets better and better! You people are dynamite!
Right? Well, it doesn't change anything.
To the extent that the Dark Knight movies, the Chris Nolan things work, I mean, I'm not a fan, but Chris Nolan has no time for any of that stuff, leaves it all by the wayside, and you know the movies are better for them.
Even though Nolan's a card carrying Snyder bro,
yeah,
you know he's fully advised on it. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the like on the noseness of the names, it doesn't, you know, it's then weirdly feels no surprise that there are so many dreadful on the nose musical cues in Snyderverse, you know, that's like, as we've already joked about, you know, saying that Englishman New York should be playing as soon as I come on. I mean, or, you know, the only reason we're not seeing, that we haven't heard Eye of the Tiger at some point during Snyderverse is because at no point was there an actual character who was in possession of a tiger's eye. Otherwise, it would be all the way through it as soon as you saw all six, you know, five of them walking down the tunnel or whatever. Dun, it would clearly...
Dun, dun, dun. Dun,
yeah. So... But like, it's so dreadful. And I wonder if there's something about the lack of sort of opacity in any of those things that actually attracted Snyder as the person, the filmmaker he is, to the franchise, to the IP, you know. If he certainly like took Watchmen and just sort of like, you know, amped up, because that Watchmen's got so many like, because it's all caricatures, right? You know, they're all references to other superheroes realistically. And then he just fucked up the one, you know, the real genius moment in Watchmen with that, you know, the final scene or the final disaster. He switches, mm-hmm. switches the topic and loses it completely, you know, because then it doesn't become that there is something bigger than humans and that's what unites us, because that's really what Alan Moore was sort of saying, is instead it's like, no, it's just a human who's just strong. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just like a really good blue human wearing like black pants. You know, it's like, that's it. You know, who cheats and does all this stuff and doesn't act when he should do. And, you know, placing him as the kind of the big baddie at the end was, you know, I feel like it kind of connects all into how he's handled the Snyderverse and its obvious characters.
The thing that's so galling to me about Watchmen is that he hewed so closely to the source material for so long. I mean, if anything, it was just a purely literal transliteration of the comic book. Mm. Until the end, when he just takes these incredible liberties with it and undercuts everything. I mean, the literal treatment of everything throughout the film undercut what Moore was doing, because Moore was too subtle for Snyder to understand. But then to just like flip the whole thing on its head at the climax of the film, just an incredible juxtaposition.
I mean, Alan Moore is a man who worships a snake god that he explicitly states does not exist. So like, that's a depth, you know, just before you even get into like, well, what did he write about in Watchmen or anything else? Straight away, that's a much more deep and evocative character than anybody in any Snyderverse film or Zack Snyder himself, you know, apparently.
Meanwhile, Snyder worships a creepy old German lady who was like a sex pervert.
And was Anne Rand a sex pervert?
Oh, yeah.
I'm assuming you were talking about Ayn Rand, unless
I was. Yeah, no, there's some
happened before the start of the podcast. Maybe, I don't know.
No, there's some weird sex stuff in her past, in her biography.
Oh, okay. I mean, for many reasons, I haven't read Ayn Rand's biography. Yeah, but yeah.
And speaking of her biography, we like to cap things off with some media recs. Do you have something to recommend to us that will help a little palate cleanser, a little something to wash away the Snyderverse. And it can be whatever, right? Books, media, music. I don't know why I put media in between books and music. But yeah, what do you got for us?
Well, I, like many people, really loved the last album from The Body, which I, from a production point of view, start off, I was like, this is where I want metal to be. And also the fact that they've got a t-shirt, they made a t-shirt on one of their tours that said anti-Sabbath, anti-riff, feels to me to be the most metal thing I've ever heard. So, you know, I'm fully repping The Body and pretty much all levels all the time. So that was really good. I tell you what, to you know, cleanse our palate a bit from the kind of just the blankness and the genericness of Zack Snyder's characterizations and the way that he just wields characters regardless of who they are and just fills them with dialogue and pushes them out there. Disco Elysium just had a final cut, like re-release. It's an amazing game, role play game, where you play a sort of despicable, terrible wretch of a man, that is a really like unsympathetic character. The game does a really good job of getting you to decide, do I want this person to be an utter fuck up or do I want him to be a communist super cop? Because here's some of the many options that you can play through this character. That's a really great game. It's genuinely really funny. It's got some really moving parts. It's beautifully shot. The art style is amazing. The soundtrack's phenomenal. Voice acting is great. World building's brilliant. So I would say, like, as an entertainment media, Disco Elysium, the final cut, is, yeah, it's the most. I mean, I've played video games all my life, and I, you know, I teach them a little bit, and I write about them a little bit, and Disco Elysium is maybe one of the best games I've ever played as an adult, I suppose. It's definitely the ones that made me both laugh and feel things the most, and I can't say that about many things, frankly, games or not. So that's got to be one.
I think that's the first game recommendation we've had.
I think it is. And I've heard nothing but good things about that game. I don't, in fact, play video games myself, but that one's always, like, my ear always perks up when I hear folks talk about it. It sounds incredible.
Yeah, it's yeah.
And when you say you teach video games, like, you teach people how to, like, beat Mario 2. That's what you're saying.
I teach people how when someone says to you, oh yeah, I used to play GoldenEye with my brother. I was really good at GoldenEye. There's a reading you can take of somebody where you go, well, let's find out how good you are, because there's a level of like, oh yeah, I beat my little brother at it. And then there's a level of that I played that obsessively as a teen at an all boys school who was not interested sexually in other men and therefore had no recourse other than to play GoldenEye, which was my life. So I feel like that's how I, that's the level of discourse that I'm working at. And that's what I try to impart to my students. Now, I mostly teach them how to, a lot of my students are interested in games. I teach interaction design, which is a broad church and moves from installation art to strange poetic computation through to weirdo games. And basically, the golden rule is, as long as it's weird, let's do it. Like, if it looks like everything else, don't fucking bother, because everything else is already there. And like, you know, are you a team of 40 people working for 2 years? No, unless you're hiding a lot under that jacket. But so I teach, like, let's do this really weird. So I talk about games a lot in that instance, because they're just, I have students who are captivated by games and want to do something strange in a short amount of time. So it's nice. It's a privilege. Yeah, it's great.
That's awesome. Ian, what do you have for us, as you are, of the two of us, the one that actually takes in new media?
Well, have I recommended The Father yet? The thing that Anthony Hopkins just won his Best Actor Oscar for?
I know you did to me personally. I don't know if you did on the show.
Gosh, I can't remember between this and the other movie podcast that I do. Well, anyway, people should see The Father. Anthony Hopkins just won the Oscar for Best Actor. Just a remarkable performance. The man, like, a storied career, decades and decades of brilliant work. And this is, to turn in a performance like this at this stage of his career is absolutely remarkable. The film is remarkable by Florian Zeller, based on his play, and it is an exploration of aging and dementia, and it is incredibly affecting and effective. Can't recommend it enough. Very good. It is, in many ways, the polar opposite of Zack Snyder's Justice League.
And as another tip of the hat, tip of the bonnet, if you will, to...
Wait, the car bonnet? The trunk? The hood?
So you get it now, Ian. You've fully understood. You're now fluent in English.
I'm with you.
Yeah. The fact that he also is as old enough and cool enough that he's like that he slept through his winning of the Oscars because he couldn't be bothered to get the train down to London to potentially win, because they had this like little hubs, because they had this dumbass rule where they were like, no one's allowed to zoom in. Like, everybody has to either be there, to be one of the hubs, which are like physical places where people can catch fucking COVID-19, where you gather a lot of people together who probably aren't wearing masks because they're on screen. You know, it's like all this sort of really asshole, stupid stuff they did. But he was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm like, you know, however old, and I'm living in a nice part of Wales, so I'm not going to London. Fuck London.
Absolute baller move. This king shit. Yeah,
exactly. I love that he was just like, yeah, no, I'm sleeping through that. I'm 85 or whatever, and I don't, you know, I don't need this bullshit. That's great.
Nat, do you have anything, or are you going to play host and opt out?
I actually, amazingly, not amazingly, but I kind of forgot about this until 2 seconds ago. The new Godspeed You Black Emperor album is hitting me where I live. Kind of like a band that was so ubiquitous, I think, around maybe, you know, the early 2000s, that they kind of became invisible for a point in time, even as they continued to put out music. I saw them live maybe 3 years ago, and they were absolutely fantastic. And it kind of like reminded me that they were a band whose output I enjoyed. And then, yeah, when I caught wave of the new album has some insane title that I'm forgetting. I'm trying to like pull it.
It's called God's P something, isn't it?
At State's End.
At State's End.
And it is spelled G blank, like underscore blank space D P, and then At State's End is all caps. So yeah, I've really been digging that, and that I have something that is not just rewatching original Law and Order or Simpsons seasons 2 through 9 is miraculous. And Wes, we've got one kind of wrap up question. And that
sorry to interrupt before the wrap up question. Tell me, drill in, because I love that Godspeed record, and I want to give you like 30 seconds more to talk about how rad it is for everybody else. Because that record has been mostly what I've been listening to recently.
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of grabbed me in. Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if I have a lot more to say other than, I think for the first time, at least to my ears, this is somewhat of a like new direction for them, right? Yeah. Like it, especially like that last song, which is almost like an ambient track, right? Because I think that was part of it too, is they did this thing where it's like, they didn't invent I'd say inventing a genre is not like a gross over-exaggeration, right? They were kind of unique in doing what they were doing, but sometimes there's a burden in that, right? Where it's just like, oh, you became so known for this thing, which is distinct, but now to continue to do it, even if you're evolving it, seems like you are just getting high on your own supply. Like, right, you're copying off your own notes. And yeah, this is for me at least kind of the first time where it's like, oh, they're going in new places, and it's all landing for yeah. me at least.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. For anybody who like tuned out of Godspeed over the last like 5 years, which I feel like a lot of people did, because there was some middling stuff in the middle there, like post that album after Yankee UXO, whatever it was called. That it's really come back, much in the same way that Low, you know, Lows, who've always made great records, but that last Low record was like, whoa, okay, now we are, this is something else happening now, great. You know, the old critique of, you know, you could walk out of a Low record 25 years ago and walk back in and, it, you know, 25 years later and it would sound exactly the same, whichever new record was out, that's now, you know, in the trash. And I feel like that way about the Godspeed record, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, my final question, are you being served?
And on that hate crime, we draw the curtain across.
All right. Thanks. Before we go, where can people be served by you? Where can people find your thoughts, your output?
The West content that they desperately need.
West content they crave. You could go, I've got one of those names that's really easy because no one else has it. So WesleyGoatley.com, at Wesley Goatley on the platforms. I've got a couple of new bits coming out on some journals in MIT Press about various media stuff, mostly about the politics of voice assistants and how much they suck and how much I hate them, and why no one should own an Amazon Echo largely. So those are all coming out in the interim, and I have some new sound art and stuff coming up in the next few months as well, and maybe even a new record, so that would be nice.
Do you think any university presses want unedited words on Justice League? Do you think there is an appetite for that?
Hey, wait, I edit these.
You know there will be. You know that there's going to be people now. Like rule 41 of the internet is that whatever thing happens on the internet, there is some first year postdoc researcher who's been like, this is what's going to make me relevant. Let's do this. Because no one's written about this yet. What does Nietzsche think about, WAP or something? I don't know. That's how it works. How academia works, man.
I know all too well.
R.I.P. Friedrich Engels. You would have loved Zack Snyder's Justice League.
What did he famously say his like favorite quality in a person was? Jolility, if I'm not mistaken, if I have that correct. Man loved a good 4-hour sad party.
I'm still reeling from you using the phrase Frankfurt Summer School to describe a sort of a very loose critical theory take. And I was like, man, I'm using that one. I'm taking that.
That's
everyone will think it's mine in the UK. They'll think like, where's the guy who brought this to the UK? Great, Frankfurt Summer School. Good on you.
I'll be over to set the record straight and fight the Queen. All right, it was great having you on, and we'll see everyone. We'll see everybody soon.
Thanks. Keep up the good work, folks. Cheers.
My dear, I like my toast on one side. You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York. You see me walking down Fifth Avenue, a walking cane here at my side. I'm an Englishman in New York. more than a license for a gun. Confront your enemies, avoid them when you can. A gentleman will walk but never run. The manners make of manners, someone said. He's a hero of the day. It takes a man to suffer ignorance and smile. Be yourself, no matter what they say.